Hey folks, and welcome to the Deconstructor of Fun podcast. I'm your host, Mishka Katkoff, and in this episode, I'm joined by my friend, Joachim Achbren. This podcast was recorded at my home, so if somebody, for some what reason, would be interested, head on to YouTube and you can watch the episode there in case you're listening to this on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatnot. In this podcast, so by the way, if you don't know Joachim, Joachim is a seasoned entrepreneur. He has funded at least a couple of game companies. I know one of them went bankrupt and the other one IPO'd. That was Next Games, and which was later acquired by Netflix Games. And after his entrepreneur journey of about 20 years, he started blogging, podcasting, writing a newsletter, and all that leads to one destination, which is becoming a VC. So now he has his fund, F4 Fund, with Mr. David K, that they are running together. Now, in this podcast, we are delving into the VC winter. We talk about key drivers in the market, the importance of identifying market drivers such as new platforms or innovations. We talk about the challenges in startup growth, how important it is to have deliberate growth strategy from early on, how important it is to focus on distribution, the innovation to differentiate your company from others in an increasingly more competitive landscape. We discuss our investment philosophies and strategies and provide our long-term outlook and different opportunities. Spoiler alert, we are optimistic when it comes to gaming in long-term, and see a lot of growth in this vast market. So anyways, this is the podcast. I hope you enjoyed. Joachim will be at GDC. So if you want to meet with him, pitch your company for F4 Fund, I suggest that you follow the link in the description. Get in touch with Joachim. He has he's a good dude. So anyways, without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Joachim Achbren. Joachim, welcome to my home.
Thanks, Mishka. It's good to be here on a sunny, cold day.
So it was super cold day. It's like minus 17, minus 18. So
that's how we roll in Finland.
Yeah, but today we're not going to talk about how cold it is. We're going to talk about venture capital, because you have become a full-time venture capitalist.
Yeah.
So if I tell the audience a little bit about yourself, Joachim Achbren, we met when you were at Supercell, so yes. You were director of analytics back then.
Yes.
After Supercell, you started your second company. Before Supercell, you had your first startup, actually. I remember you from there. But that failed. That's a different story. Yes. Then you started your second startup after Supercell called Next Games. And Next Games eventually IPO'd and was acquired by Netflix. So correct. That was your founder's path, long, tumultuous, and successful. Then after Next Games, you left Next Games and you started Elite Game Developers, a blog, a podcast, a newsletter. Sounds familiar. And that was focused on really helping founders. And you actually wrote a book as well, mm-hmm. which was called
Long-Term Game.
Long-Term Game. Yes.
Yeah, how to build a video game.
Long-Term Game. Link in the description. Yes. So you built, you wrote a book, you started a site. You had a successful podcast, a growing newsletter, and then you were like, this is not enough, I'm going to become a full-time VC, and you started F4 Fund.
Yes.
And that's where we are right now.
Correct.
What is F4?
It's an early stage venture fund, mm-hmm. investing in not only gaming, mm-hmm. but also consumer, SaaS, things that have like a bottoms-up user adoption. Like, the way that you could grow something virally, for instance. I think that's where me and my partner, David K, we're both coming from the gaming background, mm-hmm. we see that there's a lot of products out there that have those kind of characteristics, and we can spot them quite early okay. and become involved.
So not a gaming-focused fund, but gaming is one of the focuses.
It is one of the focuses.
That's interesting, because it probably coincides with the venture crash in gaming.
Well, it is in a way like finding something that could be a competitive advantage compared to the funds in the last 5-6 years, like, I don't know how many gaming funds started, probably like 20.
More.
Yeah. So you have a situation where most of those funds are globally competing with each other. Crazy competition. And then if you have a fund, you need to invest in 20 to 30 companies out of a fund, maybe 20 to 35 companies. So how many good companies can you pick in a fund in like a time span of 3 years mm-hmm. when you need to deploy your LP's money?
Yes.
I think we are in a sweet position with this fund where we have indicated that we're not going to do like a gaming fund, but rather gaming is just one of the parts of this equation. So we have more time to pick the winners that we feel are better. Like we can have like 8 gaming companies and that's totally fine. Versus like 25, which I think is a lot harder to pick winners from. So we can take our time to pick the right ones.
Okay, so you're expanding from gaming to a little bit of a broader tech with an aspect of virality is the key. Like not the virality, but maybe there has to be some kind of competitive advantage in how these companies grow.
We've seen this happen really well when founders from the games industry leave to do something else outside of gaming. That's where you can see it really happen. Like if you think about Stuart Butterfield, who started Slack, and before that Flickr, both companies started off as a games company, which is so ironic
Discord.
And funny. Yes, the same thing. Very much a gaming-focused platform.
It was a game company before that, yes. Hammer and Chisel.
Yes, exactly. So it's very common. And Thorsten, Natural Motion CEO, he left to start, after their exit to Zynga, he took some time off, and now he's running a defense AI tech company.
Interesting.
So there's a lot of patterns out there of gaming founders going outside and doing a big sort of interesting thing.
And so your focus is more on like finding these people with gaming experience, but they could be either focusing again on gaming or outside gaming.
Yes, that would be our sweet spot.
Got it. Gamification people, if you will. I'm curious to talk about this venture crash. So let's start with just defining it. Like why did the venture capital crashed? Like we've seen investments go down by 70% in terms of volume and probably even more in terms of money deployed. Of course, we're comparing it to 2020, 21, 22, which are absurd years, COVID years. But nevertheless, it's been a significant collapse in venture funding. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, there's an acronym called the ZIRP, the Zero Interest Rate Phenomenon, that era of which ended in 2022. That period of time, money was kind of cheap, and the way that you would want to deploy that money was not in sort of high interest yield assets, but rather like more risky assets. Like then you would figure out, okay, crypto is one place, but also venture capital. So a lot of money found its way to these like interesting sort of like in investment assets in VC.
High risk, high yield.
Yes, you have special funds like gaming. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, gaming, the pandemic just shot up the numbers. It's a really nice story as a niche where, you know, people coming outside of gaming, putting money there. But it's also, it happened in other tech sectors as well with VC. So VC got very like overweighted and why the crash really happened, that there's several reasons, but I want to highlight one of the reasons is LPs who deployed, they couldn't really like get liquidity as they probably would have expected. Less exits than they thought there would be. No IP window, no acquisitions, M&As dried up. So you're kind of like saying to yourself, okay, I put this much already into VC, and then the VC is coming back to me to do either a capital call or either a new fund. So for a new fund, it's easy to say, okay, we're not going to, you know, we're tapped out on VC, which means that, oh yeah, like the VC kind of thinks, okay, now I need to lengthen my investment period from 3 years to maybe 4, do less deals this year, so that I can
smaller deals, yeah. Focus on the companies that are growing clearly, yeah. And dump those that are not.
Yeah, and postpone the next fundraise into a better era.
Mm-hmm.
So like all of that circulates into a situation where you have startups that want to go and raise the next round, like pre-seed to seed, seed to series A, and there's no funds there who are deploying,
yeah.
Because they're postponing their next fundraise to a further point in history.
This episode is brought to you by Data AI. Yes, they were called App Annie back in the day, but let's not talk about that. Let's talk about how Data AI is the first company to combine consumer and market data with the power of artificial intelligence. And Data AI does this to unlock unique consumer and market insight to accelerate competitive advantages across all digital channels worldwide. What we here at Deconstructor Fund really like is Data AI's Game IQ tool. It's this fantastic market and competitive intelligence tool for mobile gaming that allows publishers to really get to the feature level of a game without doing the full-on deconstructing first. Using this tool, your team can quickly tie features to performance KPIs, which will help you make difficult roadmap decisions. It's also a great tool to identify hidden growth opportunities as you can analyze games on a scale. As you well know, there are hundreds of thousands of gaming apps in the App Store and thousands of new mobile games released each month. And while we don't want you to stop reading and listening to Deconstructor Fun, the fact is we can't cover it all. With Data AI, and especially their Game IQ tool, you'll be able to efficiently determine what features provide a lift, make roadmap decisions based on accurately modeled expected outcomes, discover how competitors lifted performance through feature releases, benchmark performance against your competitors, focus with confidence on the highest potential genre for a new game release. We here at Deconstructor Fun are huge fans of Data AI, so what are you waiting for? Go to Data AI and try the service for free. I wanted to talk to you about Heroic Labs. Building a successful game is hard enough without worrying about building your own game tech as well. Heroic Labs provides a comprehensive game stack to help you get your game into market faster and scale beyond the competition. With their Unity game framework Hero, you can cut development and prototyping time in half and quickly add social, economy, and reward systems to grow your game. Satori, the LiveOps platform built specifically for the games industry, lets you run live events, A/B tests, deliver dynamic content to players, and always keep your game growing. Nakama, the industry's leading open source game server, lets you develop locally, providing all social and competitive features for your game, and then seamlessly transition to their Heroic Cloud hosted service and easily scale to meet the largest of audience demands. Find out how to get started at heroiclabs.com.
Okay, so a lot to unpack. So market, gaming market basically reverts back to where it was, and yeah, the revenues are down. There's no IPOs happening. The interest rates go up, so you can technically just put in your money into long-term investment and securely get back like 5%,
yep.
4% easily. So there's that avenue that probably takes part of the LP's money. But most importantly, a lot of the funds haven't returned.
Mm.
And when they ask for more money for a new fund, you're not going to give it. And then a capital call, meaning that the fund that you promised money, let's say the fund is 10 million, they have 4 capital calls,
yes.
Meaning that 2.5 million comes in at certain intervals so that they can deploy it. So you don't have to give all of your money at once, but you basically pledge a certain amount. And those capital calls are, what did you mention about them?
Yeah, so like you go and ask your LPs to mm-hmm. put the next installment,
yes.
of what you've promised.
Yeah.
Which should be done like maybe once or twice a year, mm-hmm. where you do the capital call.
Yeah.
But it's like the VCs feeling that, oh, there's a, like especially in 2022 and
yeah.
last year, 23, when you were still thinking about the public markets are down,
yeah.
which is the place where usually the LPs have the liquidity.
Yeah.
So they don't want to do like drawdowns in that sector to pay the capital call.
Exactly.
So there's a stress on the VC side to postpone the capital call. So there's a lot of like, okay, let's wait for better times.
But markets are up now, so.
Now it's a different situation,
yeah.
where I think there will be more deployment of the dry powder happening. But that doesn't like mean that all of a sudden there's more exits, more M&A, more
yeah.
returns from these funds. So that's still a problem. The VC asset class
yeah.
hasn't really been what it was promised to be.
Exactly, the returns. And this is really important. I'm diving deep into this conversation because a lot of the times people talk about VCs without having any understanding of what it is,
yeah.
or having a sort of hyperbolic understanding based on Instagram or Twitter or whatever. But this is wealth management, mm-hmm. as with other classes. And you have to understand different wealth management classes, whether it's private equity or VC or sovereign wealth funds, or stock markets or bonds. Like, they have, there are different instruments with different goals, with different approaches. And so when understanding why VCs are doing something or not doing something, it's important to understand what are their incentives and how they operate. And so in this sense, venture capital works with LP, so limited partners, and depending on the size of the venture capital, if it's a small fund, then a lot of LPs are individuals, and if, when it's a large fund, then a lot of LPs are institutions, yes. like colleges, sovereign wealth funds, other companies, etc., etc. So that's the case. But I'm interested, now that you were raising for F4, mm-hmm. how was it? Was it, you started raising in 23, right?
Yes,
early that's like last year. That's the winter of the VC funding.
Yeah, it was probably the worst time.
The worst to start. Time. Yes. Good timing.
Yeah, it was like, I think the experience of not having it easy gives you the feeling later on that you actually learned a lot.
Yeah.
Compared to like if I would have been raising 2 years ago, early 2021, mm-hmm. which probably would have meant that, okay, I can just, you know,
just
2 months in everywhere and just get the money.
2 months, 10 million, 15 million, done. Yeah.
Like a bigger fund as well. Like now, like we have a much smaller fund, which yet we haven't announced. But like we definitely had the point there last year where it was like, okay, we really don't have enough to show that we can go to these institutions. We can go to family offices, fund the funds yet. We can start having discussions, introducing ourselves. It was like more, we go to our friends, mm-hmm. Founders who've had an exit and raise from them, which just meant that we would have to do a lot more smaller LP investments, a lot of them.
Yeah.
And that, it was just a lot more work.
Yeah, a lot of pitching.
Yes.
Because now you're chasing smaller tickets
yes.
in order to fill the fund.
Yeah.
And so you're talking about like 100 more people.
Yes. Which is actually kind of an okay thing. I think many people should start with a smaller fund at first, because that's where you have more like a chance to learn the ropes of VC. Because I was doing angel investing for a few years before. I was also a part of Play Ventures. But when you kind of like sit into the role of starting a new fund that hasn't mm-hmm. doesn't have any track record, everything, you need to like think about like, how do I actually present what I'm going to do with this fund? What is the competitive advantage, the thesis? And you can't really say the things that everybody else is saying, because like, a lot of people are quite sophisticated and they've already put money into what you're saying. So that was a learning experience for me, to think about like, what are our differentiations? So
I think that's crucial. Mm. Like whenever you're starting a business, you should think about why your business is going to succeed versus all the other businesses.
Yeah, it's very, very similar to startup fundraising, a VC raising from LPs. What kind of traction do you already have? It's like, how much have you raised already?
Who's your anchor?
Yes, anchor. Who's the sort of, what are the investments you've already made? Do you have like angel investments that we can take a look at? Mm-hmm. Like those kind of things.
No, well, you had like 50 angel investments. EGD had a syndicate.
Yes, well, 30.
30. Like, yes. Well, I like to exaggerate.
Yeah, it's close.
Let's call it 50.
It's good.
But that's a hefty of a background of investing.
Yeah.
How I'm curious, just because it took you, like you said, it was difficult. It took quite a while, and you had to do a lot of legwork, a lot of pitching. But with your background, I mean, Supercell, Next Games, Elite Game Developers, like 30 angel investments, working at Play before starting your own fund, it should have been much easier.
It wasn't. Like, it was very much a situation where like the circumstances of the market.
Yeah, the worst timing.
Yes, like there's too much money in VC. Like, we've already invested into these 9 funds.
Yeah.
We cannot add the third fund anymore. Yeah. And also my background in gaming meant that like I had this stamp of this is another gaming fund, even though we had the angle of we're going to do consumer apps and things like that. Yeah. Now that we've done it, several investments, we can show a portfolio of that, hey, this is actually what we said we're going to do, yeah, and we did it.
So people were so allergic towards gaming.
There's so much money in gaming VC. And of course, like my network is very substantially gaming heavy,
yeah,
where I go to talk to people who've already talked to every gaming fund,
yeah,
and might have already, the most likely candidates have already deployed into VC.
Hmm. Interesting. And what's the difference between angel investing that you were doing and venture investing that you're doing now?
Yes, that's a really good question. The way I would say is like the difference for sure is that okay, we as the general partners, me and David, can make the decisions on our own.
Yeah.
With the angel syndicate, it was like, okay, I have a deal that I'm presenting to a group of angels, mm, and then I convince people to invest. Here it's more, we can move quickly, we can create also a lot of discretion where we don't share pitch decks to 200 people,
yeah,
where we don't need to let the founder feel that this is like a, you know, crowdsourcing,
yeah,
or crowdfunding.
That's model. The problem with syndicates, especially as they grow larger, is like you're showing your pitch deck to your competitors.
Yes, exactly. I think those are the main things. And well, this becomes more like a full-time job where you're building a company, where you also like build something where the founder is looking at what you are doing as a fund versus like an angel is like an individual. There might be more to actually get from a fund, like as a, hey, well, what is the thesis? Like things like that. I think an angel could operate as a fund, like all the same things regarding like what kind of support you're doing and things like that. I think that was a natural evolution for me to think about like, what do I do? Because the syndicate model, even though it has a lot of like pros, but it also has the con of, okay, it's not a company.
Yeah.
And I'm an entrepreneur by heart. Yeah. So I feel like a venture firm is more of a company.
And now that you're, so you're a full-time venture capital, like you've limited actually the amount of content that comes, for example, through EGD. Like you're not doing the podcast anymore.
No.
The newsletter used to be weekly, but now it's bi-weekly.
Mm-hmm.
How does that feel?
I would be happy to do more content, but I'm also like conscious that like my time should be spent on building this company,
yeah,
right now more, and then putting more focus into the piece that I put out. They can have more impact, or I want them to have more impact. So it's a trade-off that just needed to happen.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, so more thoughtful, more time. But you had a good system. The weekly ones were good.
Yeah.
You could return to that.
I think they're at some point, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, I understand. And what's the life now? Because when you were doing Elite Game Developers, you were still working at Play. The content was coming at a more rapid pace. You had your syndicate and Elite Game Developers. But now you've kind of not working at Play, you're working for F4. You've limited the time that you spent on Elite Game Developers quite significantly.
Yeah.
And so where the time is going right now? Like, what is the life of a partner?
Yeah. So maybe like
Twitter
it into like
or X.
No, it's to be honest, like when you do a fund, you have your limited partner relationships. Like you're building new relationships, you're building, keeping the existing relationships. Like which is a lot of meetings, communication, sharing, updates.
Is it like a generic sharing or like what does it mean, LP, like limited partner relationship? Like do you meet them or like what is it in practice?
It's a lot of, we do try to have regular catch-ups with our LPs.
Oh,
like,
wow.
Like calls. Not with all of them. It's really like specifically tailored for people who are also investing like their own capital as angel investors who might be looking at deals. So there we do a lot of like sharing,
mm-hmm,
of what we're doing, also trying to communicate. regular updates, like bi-monthly, like a investor update, like a startup would do. That's what we craft, like a few page. Mm-hmm. This is what's happening, what the investments we've done, content we put out, and putting that out to all the LPs is something that we put a lot of focus on. But that's like something I didn't really have when I was angel investing. Yeah. So that just took up a lot of my weekly time. It's like a few days a week, which just is devoted to those LP relationships.
Wow. And how about going through pitch decks?
There's a lot more than there was before, because like there's two of us now, where the other one is seeing some deal come through, and then we're interested in it. We spend a lot more time talking about these deals together. I think that's also something when you're alone, you kind of like do more decision making inside your head, and like try to think about, is this good? Maybe you do reference checks and things like that. But here, like partner meetings are a big sort of like space of time where we do try to spend a year, like an annual, I know, a daily, like an hour or two, just talking about stuff.
That's interesting, because you guys live 10-hour time difference apart.
Yeah, how do you? It's in Los Angeles.
Yeah, here. You're in Helsinki. That's 10-hour time difference.
Yeah.
When do these long things happen?
Mornings, evenings.
God damn.
Just you know, ad hoc calls a lot. Yeah. We do have a few scheduled meetings where we talk about projects and deals. And
that's rough.
It's okay, because I think we are both entrepreneurs. Yeah. So it's like we're constantly thinking about things. And it's very organic as well. Yeah. So usually it means that we just, do you have a sec? Let's talk about
that
this
sounds
for 15
horrible.
Minutes.
If somebody would be asking me every evening, hey man, do you have a sec? I'll be like, now, well, I guess I need to have a sec, but it's evening and it's...
What would be horrible for me would be if it's in the calendar.
Really?
Yeah, that's worse.
But then you can just say like, every Wednesday, like for example, I do podcasts on Wednesdays. Mm. That is my only evening that I've devoted for that. And it's like, it's either that, this Wednesday, or if not, then the next Wednesday. Next Wednesday, then it's the Wednesday afterwards.
Yeah, we do have like a few things in the calendar, but since we want to talk on a daily basis, if I would have like every evening, sort of 15 minute time slot, that's impossible with kids and everything.
Exactly.
But this time, this kind of mode where I'm like, hey, I have free time now.
Yeah.
Do you have free time now? We've kind of settled that that's a really good mode for working. Ugh. And it works.
Talk to me in a year. That sounds horrible. Anyways, I know, David, it's good that you have a good relationship and everything, but it is challenging no matter what kind of organization you're working with. Yeah. But when the people are so far...
I don't actually stress about that too much. There's other stuff that I trust
about. Well, for sure. What do you stress about then?
Yeah, I think it's more about the way that... How do we evolve as a fund? Like, what is the next evolution of F4, which is more like, I don't really know yet. But I think like we're on a trajectory to grow the fund, most likely. But what does it look like if we add people? It's a big stress for me.
from different time zones.
Yes, because then it requires like, okay, then we need more structure. And now it's more ad hoc. Mm-hmm. And we're just, you know, doing it pretty much winging it.
Yeah.
But it's still working, because we're both looking into what we're doing. We're working asynchronously on a lot of projects.
Yeah.
And that's moving us forward. But like, can we sustain that? That we keep our appetite and motivation in what we're building?
Yeah.
So that's a question mark.
And keep yourself aligned towards the same goal, because once you grow and overall, just when you're apart, it's very easy to become unaligned, especially with more people. Mm. And then the easiest way at that point is like, okay, you take five, I take five, I invest my five and you invest in, and we'll just present that we're a united team. But frankly, like, we're working asynchronously. You do this, I do that. And it's just much easier. And that's what tends to happen behind the closed, you know, behind the doors.
Yeah. Decision making is an interesting topic in a fund where you have, like, if you would be like a solo GP fund, like, of course, you're making decisions. When you have more than one person, there's pros and cons in making consensus decisions versus like the other person being very much like against what the other one wants to do. Like that's an area where we're trying to evolve, like what are the right questions to ask the other partner about like the good things. And I think going into these are the right questions might mean is like if this becomes huge, what could it look like? Or what needs to happen in order to this to become big? And those questions often can shoot down things where we just have a fog of war. We don't understand like all the variables.
The games industry is experiencing unprecedented growth, with global revenues projected to reach a staggering $268 billion by 2025. But with more players than ever connecting across platforms and devices, how can your game stand out against the competition? AppsFlyer has created AppsFlyer for Games to help you unlock your players' true LTV by providing a wealth of game measurement solutions, unique industry insights, and proven best practices. Our dedicated hub is packed with innovative products, industry partnerships, and unrivaled expertise to ensure your game brand adapts and thrives. We understand that every game is unique, and AppsFlyer's data-driven insights allow us to cater to your specific needs. We know that in today's evolving landscape, staying ahead of the curve is crucial. Trust in AppsFlyer for Games to guide you through this exciting journey. We have the tools, the knowledge, and the passion to help you succeed in this ever-expanding landscape. Together, we'll conquer new worlds, both real and fantasy, break records, and create gaming experiences that leave a lasting impact. Get in touch with AppsFlyer for Games today and unleash your game's true potential. AppsFlyer for Games, supercharging the gaming landscape. Hey game devs, are you tired of dealing with complicated payment processes all over the world? Well, Xola's got your back with Xola PayStation. It has a simple, user-friendly interface that makes it easy for players to pay for your games and in-game content however they want. And because the Xola PayStation user interface is adaptive and accessible on smartphones, tablets, and PCs, your players will have a seamless experience no matter their preferred device. Players can save their favorite payment methods for future purchases, and on mobile, even charge purchases directly to their phone carrier bill. On the back end, you can customize your checkout with game-specific integration options like sidebars and iframes, as well as change colors, fonts, and images to make PayStation look and feel like a natural part of your game. Ready to see Xola's PayStation in action? Visit xola.pro/payments-dof or visit the link in this podcast description.
It's tough.
Well, let's talk about then those decision-making, because as an early stage fund, so let's first talk about what is the difference between an early stage fund like F4 and a late stage fund like Lightspeed.
Yes. I think everything goes into the topic of ownership that the VC gets when they invest in a company. There is like a small fund like ours. If we participate in a $10 million round, like when somebody raises $10 million, like we would not get a lot of percentage. We would get very low, probably under 1%. Which is kind of weird in a way. Okay, if that company, how many $10 billion exits there are in a year? Let's say in the games industry, zero. And that usually, like there was the Mitch Lasky and Blake Robbins on their podcast talk about like, usually these $10 billion exits means that the company has already IPO'd and then somebody buys them from the public market.
Yeah, double exit.
Yes, and that's hell of a lot harder for a VC to stick around and own those shares and wait for that big change.
Because every time a new investment comes, you need to put in more money to sit on the table or get diluted to a smaller percentage of the overall pot.
And you also have the stress of, okay, returning something to your LPs and maybe selling part of your ownership in that round.
Yeah.
So, like, if we are an early stage fund, so what we need to do in order to get more ownership, to have a chance of, okay, if there's a $200 million exit, like we're not gonna make a lot of money if we put money at the stage where it's a $10 million investment, because we cannot get the ownership that we need. So a later stage fund can put that much money and get several percentage ownership, but we would get like 0.something. So if we invest at the first situation where the company is raising at like a $5 to $10 million valuation, our small check can mean that we get 1, 2, 3, 4, 5% of this round. And that is already a meaningful ownership. Even through dilution, we still would own a lot.
Exactly. And then, so the earlier you come, the cheaper it is, and the bigger percentage you can get that then can sustain or decrease less with all the future funding rounds.
Exactly.
And that means that usually when we think about the, or talk about, not usually, when we talk about funding rounds, it's pre-seed, which is, you would determine as a team gets together, they have maybe an idea, but you're funding already just the team. Then there's a seed where they have a product market fit, sort of figure it out. There's a prototype, there's demo, there's all that, and you give them seed money. So you can hop over the pre-seed raise, just go directly to a seed, so bootstrap something on the side and make it have bootstrap, meaning do it with on the side of your main job or just without getting paid. Mm. Then after seed comes Series A. Yes. And Series A means you have tangible traction and you're raising against that traction on the market. So you have a product, the product is resonating, and now needs money to for more content and for more growth. Mm-hmm. And then you get to a B, which is basically you're already growing and let's grow even bigger. So now you get to those gigantic checks and this is, you know, you're heading towards an IPO or some other type of an exit. So with those type of rounds. Understanding these things, that after B comes C, D, and so forth. And that's usually how it is. And understanding these steps, you are investing mainly into pre-seed and seed, right?
Yes.
So that means either you've identified a great team or you have identified a great team that also has identified a product market fit.
Yeah.
And my question is, like, giving this background to the people, is like, what is an investable team?
It is very much a characteristic pattern matching that we do. Where we listen to them answer our questions, present what they're doing, with a combination of looking what they've done before, how did they do it before. We're looking for resilience, usually. I think that's the characteristic that you want in a founder.
How do you look for that?
It's a good question. Like, it really comes through partially by asking them questions about what they've done before.
As a kid.
Yes, you can start from asking, like, what was your first entrepreneurial experience? And what comes out as an answer is very telling. Then you go and talk to their colleagues or friends or people who've known them for a long time. And then you figure out those kind of questions from them as well.
And so what are you specifically looking in resilience? Is it a person that doesn't give up? Or is it a person that is, like what is it?
I think it is... Like, we do want to invest in people who are entrepreneurs by heart, where they feel that they have to have, like, their project that they're working on passionately and doing it, like, pushing themselves forward, also creating insight along the way and learning from mistakes, understanding
things. That a little bit different thing than resiliency? Because the way I understand resiliency is when, you know, shit gets tough, you don't give up. And you don't get paralyzed. It's like, like, you don't have the tools, but you still need to make it happen.
Yeah, that's true. I think one of the key components there is that you learn. And that's a component of resilience, which maybe sounds counterintuitive, but, like, there will be failures and you will shut down what you started and things like that. But if you learned, if you went through that experience and picked up things that you won't repeat, you will not do it again. I think that shows resilience in a way.
Got it. Okay. Resiliency. Yep. And then, startups is all about failing.
Maybe, maybe another point here, like what we try to do a lot, which is kind of, that talks about the founder as well. There's this, I don't know, it's Buffett or Munger who said this, but like the great founder against the bad market versus, like, the bad founder versus great market.
Yeah. Everything works in a great market.
Yes. The market wins.
Yes.
Always.
Always.
So that's also coming back to what the founder wants to do. Like, there's a bad market and they're still going there.
Yeah.
So that reflects back to what the founder thinks about.
If I'm correct, because I've listened to both quite a lot, they talk about a great product and a great leader. And then they said that in their investments, so these are the best investors in the history. I would say so, right? Well, we could just say that.
Yeah.
Or if not best, then among top 10 investors in all time history. And they made this, it was Munger who was saying this, and he was saying, because he was asked, is like, something about like, how do you recognize a good leader? I'm paraphrasing a lot. And like, they said that they have no ways to identify who is a good leader. And what is a good leader, and so forth.
Yeah.
And that's why they focus so heavily on the product. And he gave an example of Coca-Cola, which they have owned forever, and it's a pretty good company, you would say.
Yeah.
And he said that in the 80s, the CEO of Coca-Cola was mentally hampered, or so he used some kind of a word. He didn't use the R word, but he definitely ensued to that direction. And he said, nevertheless, the product was so good that it didn't matter.
Yeah.
Worst leader ever, doesn't matter. We have the great product, and that's why they said we aren't able to find, like, to really have the formula to identify great leaders and put them in charge, but we can identify great products.
Yes.
And we will invest into great products that have a great market fit, because it doesn't matter who's at the helm.
I think Buffett and Munger are late stage investors.
Yeah. Oh, very late stage.
So where you have,
they're so late that they can't even invest in most of the companies.
Yeah. There you're always looking at the product market fit. With like very clear indicators.
Yeah.
So for us, where there is usually no product market fit, there it's more about the insight that these guys have, and can we understand this insight?
Yes.
With the like knowing what the market is doing, what the founder like characteristics are. So it's, and when you have two GPs like we have, me and David, we can talk about these things from different backgrounds, where I'm coming from a different background. I have a this European mobile, very oriented, data-driven.
Versus do everything cheaply.
Yes, well, it's more like the CAC to LTV kind of thinking, what happens there usually. And then David comes from more like a PC, American background, where there's more, like you need to build stuff from the ground up. Like you don't really rely on user acquisition that much, which is great, because that like you need to have those mixes in between. Like, and we can talk about things from different backgrounds and different perspectives.
Well, let me ask you about certain elements that usually are usually present when talking about an investable founding team, and you tell me about this. Mm-hmm. So, pedigree versus scrappiness.
Meaning
pedigree, meaning like I come in from like no shade of this, but Riot, Blizzard, you name a big studio, Rockstar.
Yeah.
And you come in from an organization that has all the resources and more, and you've used to really like drive that organization towards your goal, and you might be heading a franchise and so forth, but you had an abundance of resources and you're very good at managing those. And then somebody who comes in from a smaller company has never used those type of resources, has never had access to them, and had to do with much less and figuring things out.
Yeah.
And they are the ones who use the tools first. AI, of course. Narrative designer, we don't have time. ChatGPT will do narrative. Images, Midjourney will do the images. And like trying to find different tools, trying to hustle to make things happen, to build the product, to get forward, rather than asking for more money in order to build this organization.
Yeah, there's a lot of headache that the founder is, you know, going forward into if they think that money will solve things.
Yeah, well, those headaches were taken off in 2021, 22. We saw funding rounds of seed funds going up to 50 million. Given all the resources and more, where you essentially you're just changing jobs. You get the same salary that you had at your premium AAA studio.
Yeah.
You got way more upside because now you're in charge of your own upside. And essentially, they just say, use the same resources as you used there, but it's almost like a publisher model.
Yeah, the funny thing with these companies is that which we don't really see, is most of them, like even though you raise 20 million or you raise 2 million, both these companies have an 18 to 24 month runway.
Yes.
So it's like, it's just more expensive to do this product the way you do it than the other person is doing it. So I think the sophisticated VC in 2024 knows already, like, okay, there is no expertise that is 10 times more, you know, you want to pay for it. when there are all the risks involved there as there are in the 2 million raise company. Usually that's the case. Mm-hmm. And then you also get into a point, okay, the 20 million round, you need to do a, like a $1 billion company to have a meaningful exit as a VC. Mm-hmm. And the other company, you can have like a 200 million exit, yeah, which is like a amazing result.
Yeah, and they have to raise capital, less rate.
So from
raise
the,
less.
Yeah, so the founder like should understand these dynamics, that what kind of game they're entering, where, okay, this is more like a, like consider it as a prison, like mm-hmm. if the 20 million round, because then you're committing to a certain kind of future where you need to hit this $1 billion outcome for your VCs to be sort of happy to sell,
yeah,
or happy to be like supporting you in the first, the next round and the next round.
Yeah, exactly. So, okay. So you're going more for the scrappy ones.
Definitely.
How about commitment? Like, what does it mean to you?
Commitment as a...
As from founders?
Yeah.
Like, do you measure commitment levels?
That's a good question. I think there's like the trust, what kind of person they are. We do a lot of reference checks, so it helps us to understand what kind of person we're going to be working mm-hmm. with. There is a certain level of, okay, somebody who is like this kind of wild stallion founder mm-hmm. might be somebody who breaks things along the way. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard to say, okay, we don't want to be involved in this kind of headache,
yeah,
in quotes, where the person might actually have some kind of situation where they end up also like creating hardship in the future with other people, with co-founders, everything. But if they are really good
yeah.
at like some sector of building a company, it might still make sense to invest.
Yeah.
But that's a really hard dilemma.
Well, you're making a business decision. It's not uncommon to have, you know, well, Elon Musk is at the totem pole of that,
yes,
but you would put Steve Jobs in the same category.
Yes, very difficult.
People who are like notoriously difficult and hard to work with, issues, this and that. But nevertheless, when you look at the returns,
yes,
hello.
Yes.
Like as an investor, you have to say, hey,
yeah,
wild stallion, as you said, but you need to let that stallion run.
Yeah.
If you're looking purely at the investment side, which is what VCs are supposed to do.
Yeah. And especially in the early stage, it's very cool to see when you find this kind of wild stallion type. And then think about like, should we invest or not? And then you might talk to people who know them and there's like red flags all over the place. But it still might make sense.
Exactly.
So it's very difficult.
But it's an interesting point of, I don't remember, there's this concept of a peacetime leader and a wartime leader. Mm-hmm. And in that concept, like you're talking about a constant wartime leader.
Yes.
That the person who just drives forward, there's no time, it's like, we do this now, and great for startups.
Yeah, I think the challenge there is to understand if they actually are a wartime leader who will, you know, get shit done,
yeah,
or just be dysfunctional because of their traits.
Of course. So that's true.
That's the question.
But I've noticed that that there's peacetime leaders who have no red flags, just liked by everybody. Don't make necessarily good startup leaders
mm-hmm.
because they look for consensus, they look for building a nice culture, this and that, which are super important elements. But when you have very limited runway and you gotta get the product fucking out and making money and raising funds and convincing people, it's like they don't have that fire and they don't get there.
Mm.
And they die on their way, or the company gets bought because it maybe has a good culture and so forth. So that's not a loss per se. It is a loss for a VC. It might be a more fun company to work at, but it's not a good investment.
Yeah, I think it's you want both.
Yeah.
So if the peacetime, wartime, like in a really, like where it matters.
Yeah.
That you have these times where it is like you focus on building.
There's
stuff.
So few of them. Like Zuckerberg would be a both type.
There are.
Yeah. But those are the true unicorns who can do both sides.
They are. Yes.
Yeah. Interesting. Are you a peace or wartime leader?
Probably. It's hard to say. because I really feel that now I'm doing venture fund. Mm-hmm. I think we've gone through a lot of difficult times in the last year to raise the fund. I don't know if it's something that I just didn't want to do anything else, just to focus on this one and get it through.
Yeah.
I could probably be a wartime CEO if that's needed in this situation.
I'm definitely wartime type of a person.
Yeah.
I become lazy with the peace times.
Okay.
Lazy.
Yeah. Well, you need both.
Yeah. It's a different. I like the sort of award. I'm like, what is most important now? Let's do this. Let's attack this. Let's make sure that the team executes. If somebody's not executing, we got to make the tough decision. That's fun.
Yep, it is.
But yeah, I understand that there are people who absolutely would not like to work that way. How about synergies? So this is something that is interesting. Is how do you assess the synergies between different founders? So founding team comes in, you know, you have these people who oftentimes haven't worked together. Mm. What is the assessment that you're making? Because on the flip side, on front side, you would say, hey, they are clearly liking each other. On paper, they are filling the gaps that each other has. Like, this is a technical person, this is the art person. You got the marketing person, and you got the BD person. Yeah. Perfect founding team.
It's impossible to know for sure. But what we did when we were starting F4 is, I brought this up. Like, I never had the opportunity previously. I just didn't know to do co-founder coaching, to have an intermediary in a session every month where you can openly talk about things. So what we decided to do is, we actually hired a Finnish company called Laavu.
Yeah.
And we spend a session a month, like 1.5 hours, just talking about things that, you know, in the relationship where we feel there's friction, where there's the good and the bad.
Yes.
Kind of highlighting those from both ends.
Interesting.
And it works so well.
Because people would be like, why would I need an intermediary? Here's why. When you have a founding team, basically your business partners, then, and you're trying to make something happen as business partners, the last thing that would, to most people, that would come to mind is like, let's start fucking fighting.
Yeah.
It's like, no, you just swallow your things. You're like, you know what? I hate when this person does it. Yeah. It is what it is. Mm. We have a mission and we need to complete. Like, you're not going to do a retrospective or stuff like that. Yeah. But the problem is that it should be done, because when you swallow these things, they bottle up. Yeah. And when they bottle up, they will break down the line.
Yeah, and you're every day swallowing it again.
Yeah.
And it could sound like it's a kumbaya thing that you're doing.
it's a therapy session.
Yeah. It is a therapy session.
It's a couples therapy.
Yeah. It is couples therapy, which impacts your well-being so much.
Yes, because you can get things out. You're like, like David would say, I hate when Joachim does this. Mm-hmm. Like, it drives me crazy because I want to do things this way and he does this way. And you'd be like, oh, interesting, I didn't know that. But the reason why I do these things is this, this, this. And in my previous experience, X, Y, and Z have been like, oh, okay, well, that makes a lot of sense. But it would be crazy to bring it up in some call, and it could cause a fight, and especially as men, that's the last thing that you want to do.
Yeah. Like, the process for us is that, like, we do, like, work constantly crazy, like pushing forward, and then there are situations where I'm like, okay, what did he mean with that?
Yeah.
Like, what was the, why are we
with
doing
messages,
this?
With messages, written messages. Kind of
like, yeah, well, it is like some expectation management as well, or expectations that come from feeling like, oh, we're not, you know, doing this or that enough, or sometimes you're not doing enough of this. And then we can talk in this session very openly, mm-hmm. and also find a balance to go forward. And then in a month's time, we can reassess what's been happening. I don't know, like, I haven't really gone to a point. This is something we've been toying around with, but, like, why wouldn't a venture fund actually create a deal? Like, you have all these, you know, data AI cheap package if you join our, if you raise money from us, we get a discount from you. Why not a Laavu discount?
Why not? You're a venture capital funder. You can create a deal with them that they support your guys?
I've sent a few people already to them, founders. But it is a bit of a, okay, we educate, like in this kind of format, we say that we're doing this co-founder coaching. It's not about like, oh, you should do this. Yeah. But hey, this worked for us. I'm not saying you should do it, but this is a really good option for you.
Yeah, they are. They're one of the things that some of the funds that I've talked to have said that they would bring on executive coaches. So that's another thing that can help you. But that is a little bit of a different thing. That is how you drive your team. That's probably more towards like Series A type of a support.
Yeah, execution.
Execution advisory, really like finding yourself as a leader. Because one of the interesting parts about the startup journey or anybody's startup journey is for most people, it's the first time that they are in this position. And yet again, like when you are the CTO, the CMO, the CEO, the COO for the first time, but people see your title, they're like, well, you're a CEO of this company. You should know what to do. Mm. I was like, well, no. I was kind of promoted to this position by myself. So
the fact is that everybody's learning everything constantly. There's new stuff that you can explore.
But the expectations are totally different.
Course. Like you're the sort of, you should know everything.
You should know it, yeah.
That's the biggest cliche ever. You should know these
because of your title. Yeah. Okay, so we talked about synergy. We talked about commitment. Commitment was more as like, how committed are you at doing a startup? And this is what I talked to people about. I was like, are you ready to get paid $3,000 a month? Mm-hmm. And you know, for some people that's enough, but for other people who have been getting like 10 to 15, even though it's not about, like they're not gonna go broke, but they're like, wow, that is a quite of a hit. And I remember for me, it was quite of a hit just on a self-esteem level where you're like, I'm really not paid well. Like I'm getting less money than I was getting at my first job in games 15 years after.
Yes.
And it plays games in your head.
Yeah, that is it's kind of like what we do as a job with like when we talk to a founder who's pitching us.
Yeah.
Like we have like 100 questions that we should be asking. For instance, like the commitment side of things. So for that, I think one of the high level questions is like, how much runway will you have if you raise this money? And okay, do you have a data room where you're projecting like your spend like per month? And then we can look at salaries and things like that. So it's more about like, what kind of signals can we pull out of the stuff you send us?
Yeah.
And that will show more than us asking an individual question for each thing. So we just look at a lot of material and then we can find the red flags there.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the commitment part is very interesting. And the commitment part comes to also to a sense that you can see in your investments that people just lose the commitment to it. Yeah. They're like, this is going nowhere, which is absolutely normal feeling with any startup. In the beginning, when you just raise the fund, you're thinking that this is the next NVIDIA or Epic or Unity, if you will, or Supercell.
Yeah.
And then very quickly, the reality subsides is that you are nothing. And you're not getting paid. Mm. Your product is not that great. Everybody else is going faster. The market is this, it's that. And it's like, it's really, really daunting and depressing to be a startup founder. And that is where the commitment is. It's like you need, like in when you're saying about these wild stallions, it's like I would rather put money on those people who are crazy because I think you have to be crazy to do a startup.
Yeah.
It is not logical.
No, it isn't. That's the truth.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like a drive to see this happen.
Yeah.
Like the question we attempt to always ask is, why are you doing this?
Yeah.
Why are you doing this company?
Yeah.
And that will tell you a lot about the person.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great question. And in that sense, also, it's a very good position to kind of align on. It's like, what is their reason? Because if the reason is to get rich, we can align on that. That's good. I want to return funds. You want to make something big because you worked here and you believe you can make the same things and take the same earnings. That's fine. But when I find it hard to align, when the founders come up with lofty goals, like, oh, I want to create the best culture for, it's like,
I'm funding a business.
Yeah.
Like, you've been reading too many books. Like, you're talking about the things that happen when you have a successful company, and not even necessarily there. We know plenty of companies. The biggest company in the world, Microsoft, is not known for their outstanding culture. It's known as a corporation.
Yeah.
And it's still the most valuable company in the world. Nobody who's invested in Microsoft would be like, God damn it, if they only would have a good, like a prestigious culture. It's like, people are like, no, I like it because they're at the forefront of technology every time and have great products and moats and so forth. So in that sense, like, I find it very difficult to invest in teams that are not business focused. It's like, your goal is to get the product out, to be profitable, to be competitive, to make more with less and dominate. It's like, all right, let's go.
Yeah. And there's also the risk taking that the founder is taking is a topic which is really interesting to look at. Like, are they using up their savings?
Yeah.
That is a risk.
Yes.
Are they taking like a loan for the company?
That's bad.
That is bad, but it still shows like commitment, things like that. So I think the risk level can come up as a way to assess commitment.
Yeah. And I'm actually not like I know there are some funds and that like the founders to take a very, very tiny salary. And I agree that should be in the beginning, because you have to create hardships in order to be successful. I believe so. Like, you know, pressure make diamonds, whatever you want to say. But I think it's important that you're not paying yourself well, because that gives you the feeling of you need to move fast in order to get to a stage where you can reward yourself with a normal salary. So I believe with that. At the same time, I'm of the opinion of, like, when you get to Series A, you have to pretty quickly start rewarding the founders for their path, because this is something that came up with Anton Krasny, for example, in the podcast, is a founder of Murko. And he was, you know, the point that he was making and that I was kind of interpreting is, if you're constantly in the stage of like, I'm not getting paid, I can't get a car, I can't have a house, I have a kid and I'm like poor, but I'm a CEO of this company, that's not a good position either, given that your company is scaling. Like, your company is worth tens of millions already, and you barely can make your, you know, payments, and you can't go to Starbucks to buy a coffee. I think that is unsustainable also. So you have to kind of find that happy medium where in the beginning you go into this cockroach mode and you do everything as cheaply as possible and move as fast as possible to a position where you get traction, you're hopefully generating revenue, and now you're paying yourself normally and eventually getting secondaries as well, so that you're more committed to this company in the long term, that you get settled, because part of that stress, part of that that sort of aggressiveness that founders have is also being hungry. And when you satisfy a little bit, when they can get their houses and their cars and kids and all that set up, then they're like, okay, I got all my basics, everything that I need done. Yeah. Now I can put my effort and my soul into building this into a you know, long lasting company.
And not
sell it as soon as possible.
Yeah, that route, definitely I can buy that.
Okay. And then last one out of these, path to profitability. Like, that was never really a question in 2020, 21. It was like, you will raise pre-seed, seed, Series A, Series B. The profitability is not really an issue.
Yeah.
But now we see in all the companies and all the tech, the profitability is a very important thing. So when you're seeing these calculations, when these teams are pitching you, how much are you focusing on what is their path to profitability?
It's more, I think profitability is a number that, like, or a metric that you can assess on, like, the likelihood of this company has been de-risked. Mm-hmm. To a certain state at that point in time. But I think there are different kind of numbers and metrics to look at, like insane user retention, things like growth through an arbitrage that is unique to this company.
Yeah.
And people can spot it when they get to know the company. Like, there's other kind of value that can be created. And I think it's more about the thing where you're asking about road to profitability comes from a place where you were really betting that there's always going to be the next round because this company is growing with metrics that mm-hmm. were probably vanity-ish metrics or certain user growth that was not sustainable.
Yeah.
So I think we're going to a place where there's more sustainability on business growth, where profitability can be one of those numbers that you look at.
Yeah.
But I think it's risky to have it as the only kind of like goal.
I've seen some cases that come in with studios that with founders that are pitching a studio, and the type of game they want to make is incredibly ambitious.
Hmm.
And you ask them like, okay, so you're going to go for pre-seed, it's going to give you $500,000.
Yeah.
What are you going to get for $500,000? They're like, we're going to get there. How much are you going to raise then? We're going to raise that. Mm. Is that enough? No, that's not enough. So seed is not enough. And you're going to go like how much are you really raising? And they're talking about tens of millions to get something done.
Yeah.
And that is in the like it used to work when you get like Andreessen or Lightspeed and you have a good pedigree and a great team. They could raise that 20, 30, 40, 60 million for a startup and start building the type of a product they want with some, you know, with not many trade-offs, to be honest. Yeah. But we haven't seen those work. I mean, I think Secondarin is the only one that has been successful. And I don't know if you know, is it successful from venture funding perspective?
No, like taking an example of a mobile game studio, which you have... You raise the pre-seed, like this is the default how it happened previously. You have a team, experienced team has a pitch for a new match 3 game.
Yeah, of course.
They raise.
Hybrid casual.
Yes, $2.5 million. They start working. 12 months to 18 months later.
$1 million spent.
Yes, or half, let's say, or close to two. And they have done technical soft launch and they have some retention numbers to share, and they need to go raise the next round. It doesn't work that way anymore. It's very hard to go from this 2.5 to raise 5 or 6 or 7.
Well, from 2.5, you would have to raise 10 to 15.
Yes. Well, you need to do some kind of,
to
make it like work, the venture path to work. What happens now is there's nobody there who's happy to fund that kind of progress.
Yeah, because it's a risk. Because now you're giving a lot of money to see if this scales.
Yes, and it hasn't yet proven or de-risked anything.
And it looks like everything else. And you're like, okay, interesting. And so now you have this pretty slick demo and you need 10 million?
Yes.
Yeah, we need 10 million to really start. Where does this 10 million lead you? It's like, well, we're going to reach global launch and then you're going to raise more to fund your UA. And we know that UA is a mess and so forth and so forth. So it's like you start calculating, like, I'll give you 5 now, your other investor is going to do pro rata, so follow the investment. And then the next round, I need to give you 10 probably. Mm. And that's only, like, that's when we start seeing if you're really worth it.
Yeah, it's the game isn't going out.
Yeah.
If you don't launch properly to show that this can be scaled, if you cannot prove the scalability with the first raise, I think you will have a lot of headache later. It's not impossible to raise, but the odds are stacking against you. Mm-hmm. And I think all the VCs in gaming are starting to realize this as well, that they just don't bet on gaming studios unless there is like a hell of a lot of de-risking happening during the runway that you get from the raise.
Yeah. And that's why I think the path to profitability is very important, because if you have a studio, like they might have said, like, we're going to go and build this next, you know, RPG game.
Yes.
It's like, well, de-risk it, make it so that you can get out in the market with 1 million and not spend the whole 2.5 to get a demo out.
Yeah.
And I think that's a major change in the way the market operates.
And especially in mobile, which is very competitive.
Saturated.
Like, yeah, what kind of level of content do you need to have to actually have a shot at like having a positive return on your ad spend?
Yes.
It's not like a million or two will cut it, especially in the Western like market where salaries are typically a bit like, okay, you're going to be spending like 100K at least a month.
Exactly.
So 2 million, you get like 20 months. And you need to go to the market and raise again, probably a lot earlier than the 20 months. So it's that's what doesn't work.
Yeah. All right, last question. Aaron Gurker posted, like a lot of people posted, but he had few, and I'm going to just take some of them. What are the market drivers that you're seeing right now? Like, what is driving the market on gaming side? Innovations?
Yeah, I think you want to see new platforms come out, because then you have a blue ocean opportunity where if this, like just the question that I'm asking and we are asking, which we talked about earlier, if everything goes well, how big can this become? And what needs to go well? Like, if those questions are, like, not very risky to say that they could happen to this company, it's great. And usually that requires a blue ocean opportunity, like a new platform.
Like Roblox.
Yeah, I don't think it's, like, you have a challenge in these kind of environments that have been out there for a while. A lot of people have tried and attempted.
Yeah.
And you can see the bodies already in the graveyard.
Yeah.
And you can ask the people who knew those people before they died, like what happened.
Yeah. And UFN, Roblox, but you have to kind of go in early, because there are success cases there, but they're not as plenty. So you're trying to, like, when new platforms form up, if you get early and that platform does grow, then you're in a good place. Because if you got early into VR, but that didn't grow, you're kind of fucked.
Yeah.
But, you know, you kind of have to take the bet.
Yes. I think one of the interesting developments is the whole Apple spatial computing thing, which opens a new market.
Interesting.
But the problem is that, like, it's going to take many years until there's enough market penetration there with that device. Form factor needs to get better. Which I'm a believer that it will, like, eventually happen, that we will get rid of laptops and we will use that kind of interface for a big monitor and a keyboard. So going into that area now is probably too early, I would say, to place a bet.
Yeah.
Of course, there will be these bets where it's like the pedigree investing
will
happen into that
exactly.
space
if
already.
You, even now, if you come in and you invest super early, like a pre-seed into a team that clearly can deliver in this market that is not there.
Yes.
But nevertheless, they will be so early that they can get hot, like acquired by another company
Could
that
be.
Just needs that talent. And you get the sort of like an early Oculus effect or so forth where they just acquire that team. But you have to be very early in the investment and really locate that team.
Yeah.
Doesn't fit big investors, but early investors can make a move.
There might be opportunities already in Vision Pro, like in the spatial computing platform, because if you can become an aggregator of content in there, like a distribution platform for spatial computing, like things like that can already happen with a smaller device penetration.
Yeah, but so, it's a long-term bet.
Yeah, and it's different from content, like an app investment.
How do you look at competitive edges when, or moats, or stuff like that? Like, I know in the GameCraft podcast, it talked about distribution, competitive edge and distribution. It's like, how do you look at those?
We look at switching cost a lot.
Switching cost, okay.
Yeah, usually we are still investing in things where there is a competitive landscape established already. So how do we pull people away from what they're doing already to this thing?
Mm-hmm.
And carving out niches is great, where you just didn't realize that the switching cost is actually lower for certain people who really need this solution. We talk a lot about this book called Seven Powers by Hamilton Helmer, which is all about the moats and everything.
Oh, yeah, the economy of scale and that kind of stuff. Yeah, I've read it.
Yeah, so we talk about that a lot internally with David about, like, how do we see this company and how does it relate to what the Seven Powers kind of like outlines.
Interesting. And when it comes to overall investment philosophy, is this something that you have written down and you're comparing against this, or is it more ad hoc based?
It is very much like a pattern matching exercise. We do see so much stuff, and we constantly talk about everything we see. So we haven't written down, but it is in a way whenever we talk about companies, there are certain topics that come up always. It is like oral currently, but it works.
Yeah, because you're a scrappy startup.
Yes.
And when you grow, you have to have everything written.
Yeah, I think there's also the way that if you think about like giving power to your employees, like if we would have people, we would still want them to develop their own conviction as investors around
theses.
Yes, why they like certain spaces and them placing bets on like how they see things.
Yeah, well, I've seen the deck, or not the deck, but internal material of larger, like large funds, and they are very thesis based. And if it's outside the thesis, there's no investment.
Yes, that like relates to, like this is something I learned from fundraising with LPs, is you have, LPs are looking at VC, there's subcategories in VC, like like if you would invest in the public markets, you would buy S&P, you would buy, you know, index, different kind of index
funds. NASDAQ 100, shout out to NASDAQ 100, great, great
buy,
ETF.
Like, you would buy like different kind of ETFs from different sectors.
Defense ETFs.
Yes, good you would, like crypto or whatever. You're deploying in different areas. So an LP who looks at VC might say that, okay, I have these kind of geographies covered here, these kind of sectors. So the thesis is more about giving the LP a more clearer base to understand where they bucket you.
Exactly.
But also it does help you to think about like where your circle of competence is.
Yes.
Are you investing in something you definitely don't understand?
Yeah.
You shouldn't probably do that.
Or have competitive advantage in those investments.
Exactly.
100%. Last question. 24, 25 from a VC perspective.
Yeah. I think things are looking better.
What?
Yeah.
Well, they are? Well, stock market is looking better for sure.
Yeah, well, like, we're not going to go back to what it was. And that's something we need to realize. Like, the competitiveness of gaming makes it really hard to have exits. Like, there probably will be consolidation waves again, which are impossible to predict. But gaming is so huge, and it's not stopping the like, if you think about the kids of these days, there's nothing else than video games that pulls people's attention.
TikTok.
Yes.
And social media.
It's everywhere.
Yeah.
Gaming is everywhere.
Yeah. Well, gaming is in TikTok as well.
Yeah. So just thinking about, like, my son, who's 12, his hobby is to create YouTube shorts of Fortnite that he plays. And he's like growing a channel.
You should start making
now.
Roblox games.
No, but like it is so kind of, that's a hobby.
Yeah.
Like, gaming has a really bright future, but we're just in a lull because of challenges with venture returns.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's...
But we're also in a challenge of unsustained growth during the last few years that came in because of government, well, like because of lockdowns and because of money printing, which are just all anomalies. And that is why I find it confusing when people compare even growth numbers to, like, well, in 21, it's like, no, there was no 21. Yeah. Erase that. Was that when people were given free money and sat at home? Yeah. That doesn't happen because they were building, like, Meta invested, what, $20 billion into Metaverse? Like, that's not true.
Like, it's not that binary, to be honest, like, good or bad in the industry. I think it's more like how harder it is now.
Yeah.
Like, it's 4 to 5 times harder or something.
Yeah, and well, I meant more in terms of, like, what it was a couple of years ago is, you don't compare to that. Compare it to 2019, 2018, when the market was more normal rather than like these very unique time periods.
Yeah.
And so in that sense, yeah, but please go on, like 20, 24, 25. So looking better, things are clearing up.
Yeah, like I do want to reiterate that the whole possibility of like raising for a mobile studio with the existing, CAC to LTV playbook, you need to come up with some distribution innovation already.
Super important.
Yeah, it's like if you're doing the same old
like, lean startup mythology. Yeah, we're going to make fast games. Yeah, we're going to throw them at the market. We're going to see some numbers. Then we're going to put UA money against that, and then it's going to grow. It's like, that is dead.
Yes.
You have to approach it from a deliberate startup model where you start first thinking about, how are you going to market this?
Yeah.
There's a product market fit, and then that part of that has to be, this is how we grow this.
It's an established market.
Yeah. Like,
what is your edge?
Yeah.
And you go from there. And, it's not hard. It's just the reality.
It is hard because, like, if you go, like, that is really important for listeners who are thinking about pitching, is like, whatever the company you're planning to make, like, just think very thoroughly of how you're going to grow it and pitch it with that angle. If you can't find that angle, then you don't have a company. Then you're going to pitch for 6 months. Maybe you'll find a VC who's going to give you some money that's not going to be very educated VC.
Yeah.
And then you'll be running that startup for a while, for a year or two, waste your time because you won't get a follow-up round because you've never figured out how to grow that, whatever you're building.
Totally correct.
Yeah. So it's a question to answer first. And I think it's important to have people, marketing-focused people in your even founding team, because that has to be, you know, day one focus.
Yep.
Yeah, the platforms are not growing by themselves.
No.
No.
Yeah.
Did we cover most of it?
I think we did.
For the first time, all right. We covered a lot. This was a conversation everywhere because we've had so many conversations. You were an advisor at my company, an investor in my company. So this is not like the first time we're sitting down.
No, but these are really fun chats. Yeah.
All right, so in the comments, you will see Long-Term Game, Joachim's first book, not the last book.
No, there's more.